Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel and I'm your host every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 10, and on Saturdays at 4. We're brought to you by Montecito Bank and Trust, proudly serving our communities and their financial needs for over 40 years. Pierre LaFon Wendy Foster, offering fine clothes, good food, and vintage wines. Habitat for Humanity, building strength, stability, and self-reliance through shelter. And CSU Channel Islands, no matter which of their academic programs you choose, you will be at the center of your educational experience. And speaking of CSU Channel Islands, we are fortunate to have Tim Allison, an adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science. Hi, Tim.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So I'd like to just step back a second. We're going to talk a lot about politics and in this moment in time, it's great to have a political scientist on. But I'd like to go back to 1835. And I know you and I aren't that old, although we're getting old. But in 18...
Some days I feel it.
Yeah, exactly. Alex de Tocqueville did that seminal work about American democracy. And one of the things that was of concern to him was whether or not a democracy could survive without an educated electorate. And I'm wondering how prescient that is, given what's going on today and with the tribalism and with some of the, quite frankly, ignorance that is pervasive in our society.
Yeah, I think it's very relevant to today. I mean, his seminal work of Democracy in America couldn't be more relevant today than it was back in the 1800s. He was worried about what would happen with democracy, and I think he's right to be worried. The events of late have kind of sent a message to all of us that the democracy that we thought was strong, stable, and solid might not be as strong as we thought. It's something that we have to work at. It's something that we have to defend on a regular basis. And the institutions of democracy are more fragile than we thought.
And Jefferson and that crowd back in the late 1700s, when they created the Electoral College, which I think some of us are not particularly happy with today. They did it for that reason. I thought they had this elitist view, but there was some truth to it that they wanted to have a check on a electorate that didn't have either a vested interest in the future of the country or the ability to make good judgment.
Yeah, they definitely wanted to protect us from the masses. They wanted to have a check in there, but they also did it for some very practical reasons. Back then, Americans thought of themselves as not Americans, but as Virginians or New Jerseyites or New Yorkers. And so it was a way to reconcile the small states and the large states and put together a system that could get buy-in from both sides and still pass, still have a constitution that could run the country. And now the question I think is relevant is whether that is a system that is still needed and still relevant to this day.
Well, it's interesting you say that because right now we have an electorate that's so tribal. Maybe it's not about being a Virginian, but it may be about somebody who has a job in a steel mill or a coal mine or an investment banker that has an interest in not what's good for the country, but it's good for their family and what's good for them.
Yeah, we have definitely become tribal. There's no better indication of it than you have some conservative Republicans from the South that are now against football and in favor of Kanye West. That tells you something.
Well, what's also amazing is now you have Democrats that care about the deficit and Republicans that think everything is working out fine.
I think it's a sad state of affairs when we're more concerned about who proposes an idea than about the quality of the idea.
So you're a professor at a great university. Are you finding an energy among the students about what's taking place in their country, or is there I noticed since the Vietnam War ended, college campuses weren't as activist as they used to be. Are things changing for the better now?
I think things are changing for the better, but it's probably too soon to tell. I think there's an energy, there's a fear, there's a concern. There's also an earlier cynicism. People are worried about what's going to happen. They see, what happened in terms of the Parkland students, and they think that now it has to change. And then for every month that goes by when it doesn't change, there's also a cynicism. I don't think we're seeing the activism, certainly not the activism that we saw in the 1960s. But we are seeing students more engaged. They have an understanding that it's their generation's time to step up and do something, and probably just in time. The millennials actually are the majority of the potential voters, but not the majority of actual voters.
So let's step back a second and talk about your favorite subject, you. You're a lawyer, you're an attorney by training. How did you get involved with political science?
Well, these days, I don't know that it's my favorite subject. I actually have fun talking about public policy, but I did come to teaching through kind of the long route. I was involved in political campaigns. I ran a bunch of political campaigns. I got people elected to public office. Tried once myself. That didn't go as well. And was over in Australia for a couple of years working, which was an incredible experience. And I guess all along I'd known by the time I got out of law school that I didn't want to be a practicing attorney. I knew of way too many unhappy attorneys. But by the time I got back from Australia and was trying to figure out what the next move was and got invited to teach a couple of classes, I had been kind of running away from the family profession, which was teaching. And I realized that there was something to this, that for me, it was like a fish discovering that it didn't have to walk anymore, it could swim. I absolutely love the energy, the excitement of the intellectual discourse of a college campus, and have found that I'm actually pretty good at it, and I truly enjoy it.
Well, the students feel the same way. In 2018, you were awarded the Faculty Member of the Year Legacy Award by the students. So obviously, the students getting the benefit of your teaching
Well,
skills.
I was thrilled with that because it was an award that did come directly from the students. So it's kind of a two-way street. The feedback and the response from students is kind of what makes it all worthwhile.
There was an interesting editorial about a month ago in the New York Times about what makes a good teacher. And one of the things the author pointed out is one of the worst teachers in the history of teaching was Einstein. When he taught at Princeton, people would walk out of his class. And the reason for that was he didn't really understand the process of getting something because he got it. He just got it automatically. So he couldn't break it up into intuitive or easy to understand modules, and he just was incomprehensible. And one of the things about teaching is there may not be a direct correlation between the knowledge that you possess and the ability to communicate it. And obviously, you have been able to bridge that gap.
One of the things that I realized right from the very beginning was that students learn differently. And so I actually, in every one of my classes, whether it's an upper division political science class or a lower division required class, I have students take a learning quiz. And what I want to know is, what kind of learner are they? Are they an auditory learner? Are they a visual learner? Are they kinesthetic? Do they need to touch it and feel it in order to gain a comprehension and an understanding of it? Sometimes I even have the students teach their classmates and make sure they hit each one of those three learning styles, in order for them to understand that their colleagues in the class learn in a way that's different than they do.
That's why I love CSU Channel Islands, because the focus is on the student and student learning as opposed to how many articles the professor wrote.
Yeah, it's a great place. I absolutely love it here.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, using innovative social-emotional learning and character building to help teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here today with Tim Allison, a professor of political science at CSU Channel Islands. And we're talking about the political situation today. And, you know, when I was in grade school, we had a civics course. I wonder if the process of getting people involved should begin it back when it did in my day in the third, fourth, and fifth grade, and to learn about civics and learn about the responsibility of the citizen.
You know, Neil, that's actually a great point. I was fortunate enough, I guess 20 years ago now, to be an international election monitor going observing the elections in Mexico City, in DF, the capital city. And Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas was running for mayor of Mexico City. And it was fascinating because for 70 years, one party had been in control, and this was a somewhat free and fair election. The people were very, very into it. And one of the things that I walked away from just amazed was that at the polling places, parents took their young sons and daughters with them to the polls. And these students voted. They didn't vote for a candidate. They voted for values, and they could vote for as many as they wanted to. But watching their reaction coming out of the polling place with the excitement and enthusiasm of their first voting experience, I always felt that that would help create lifelong voters. And I've always wondered why we didn't do that here in the United States.
Well, you spent time in Australia, and I believe Australia is a country that requires everyone to vote, and they've got like a 95%.
It's mandatory voting, and it's not easy either. You have to, if there's 14 candidates, you have to rank each and every one of the candidates. And if you miss one, then your vote doesn't count for that race. So it's mandatory, and it's a bit complex.
And there's, unfortunately, some political groups that are trying to make it more difficult in this country to vote. The idea of restricting voting is so anathema to the whole idea behind a democracy that that in itself is very frightening.
Yeah, it is interesting because we have competing trends in this country. We have some states that are opening up voting. They're doing things like all mail-in ballots so that every voter gets a ballot. They're opening it up. Some states, you don't even have to have voter registration. You can do same-day voter registration. They're making it easy for individuals to exercise their franchise. And yet in other states, they're making it more difficult. They're returning us to some of the days of Jim Crow laws where voting becomes not easy, but a chore, where they're eliminating early voting. They're consolidating polling places to make it more challenging for people and to make people have to wait in line in order to exercise their vote. And it's a really disturbing competing trend, and that tends to be part of our tribalism.
So about a week ago, I had professors from CSU Channel Islands on talking about the Z program, Zero program, which is an initiative at the school to eliminate textbooks because of the cost of textbooks and to create a system where the professor curates their own material. And I wonder if for political science, whether there's a benefit to doing that even beyond the cost savings, because things are changing so rapidly. The political science textbooks of 20, 25 years ago, I wonder how relevant they really are today.
Yeah. I do that for some of my classes, not all of them. Some of the classes like constitutional law or civil rights and civil liberties are very case-based. And so we have to, we have to dig into Supreme Court cases. But I have other classes like my transfer student seminar classes where it's current events and cultural literacy. We are able to teach a class with curated material and without textbooks because we're talking about what's current and relevant and applying that to history and culture. And so it's a wonderful way, for me, it's a wonderful way to do a class without having to rely on a textbook that's going to cost a student $130 or $140.
So you mentioned constitutional law. The process of confirming Kavanaugh revealed not just the political divide, but also the way he was cultivated. You know, the Federalist Society essentially has this program, if you will, to bring up through the ranks people with an ideology. It's sort of like they teach ideology before they teach the process of really making fair decisions, and it's sort of frightening.
Yeah, the Trump administration has placed, and it's not just the Supreme Court, it's at all levels of our court system, the district courts and the circuit courts as well, have placed a premium on appointing very conservative judges. And he's done that at a faster rate than any previous president. And that will have a lasting impact on policies in this country for decades to come.
And, you know, the whole argument that, you know, we should not be an activist judge, whatever that means, and look at the intent of the Constitution. But they're not really doing that. That's sort of the paradox. The paradox is they're saying that anyone that disagrees with them is an activist. But some of the decisions that have come down are so radical, at least from my standpoint, that they're using an argument that sort of can be used against them about being activists.
Well, there's so many ways to respond to that. I mean, first of all, you have a brilliant document, a constitution that was it's very short. It's not very many pages. It stood the test of time and it served this country well. But it was also a document written by an elitist few and not for everybody. In fact, only 6% of the American population voted for George Washington for president. And most of Americans weren't eligible. Unless you were a white male property owner, you weren't part of the decision-making process of this nation from our earliest times. There's Thurgood Marshall that says, you know, of course this is a document that should be amended and should be amended frequently, because it was a document that didn't include us, and he used us pretty broadly. And so, you know, over time we have expanded the franchise, we have expanded the representation in this country. We've tried to protect the nation against the tyranny of the majority. Yeah, I do this great exercise with my students, and I say, okay, all of the men and all of the women in this class, you're in, you know, the male group or the female group. Why don't I let you vote? You can vote on which group of you fails this class and which group of you gets A's. Wouldn't that be fair? Because it's democracy. Shouldn't it be the majority rules? And they nervously look around the classroom and try to figure out whether they're in the majority or they're in the minority.
Right.
And so we have a process, a system in this country to try to protect against a tyranny of a majority. And so when they say activist judges, you know, you have to have a living constitution, because this constitution didn't account for net neutrality. This constitution doesn't talk about whether freedom of speech includes speech on the internet. This constitution has to change with the times.
Well, you know, you talk about the tyranny of the majority in both the Gore election and in the Trump election. They didn't get the majority of the popular vote. So, you know, here you have the tyranny of the minority, in given the way our system is structured.
In bringing that to the Supreme Court, you actually have a system where four of the last six Supreme Court justices were appointed by a president who was initially elected without a majority of the vote.
Well, that's an interesting statistic. I hadn't realized that.
Speaking of statistic, let me try a trivia question on you. Let's see.
Okay.
Let's see how your trivia receptors are working today.
Okay.
So this fall, it looks like we will have if the polls are correct, we will have a Democratic governor. Gavin Newsom's way ahead in the polls. And so if he is elected, it will be a Democrat following a Democrat as governor of California. When was the last time in California history that a Democrat was elected after a Democrat?
Well, if I get it wrong, I have to plead that I'm a New Yorker.
Well, you have the power of editing, so you could also change this before we go on air, correct?
You just gave away that we're pre-taping the show. Let's see. 1984.
Well, you got at least one of the digits right. The last time that a Democrat followed a Democrat in California history was 1887.
Wow. But of course, back in 1887, the Democrats were the Republicans were the Democrats.
Good point.
Yes.
We think of California as such a democratic state, but that statistic is pretty telling in terms of that the democratic trend is a relatively recent one.
Well, and I can actually opine on why that's the case, and that is, you know, California was this rural state, and as it became over the last 100 years more and more urban, the percentages of the majority changed.
I think the same thing is happening in Texas right now.
Well,
Pretty interesting transition.
yeah, I don't know if it's happening fast enough. You're listening to AHA Presents on the Santa Barbara News Press Radio Station. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, Improving Attitude, Creating Social Harmony, Bridging the Achievement Gap for Teens. I'm Neil Kreisel, and I'm here today with Tim Allison, a professor of political science at CSUCI, Cal State University at Channel Islands. So how do you convince your students to vote?
You know, we talk about the history of voting, the fact that you know, individuals gave their lives for the ability to vote. You know, back that's in some ways it's how this nation was founded. We had the slogan back in our revolutionary days that taxation without representation is tyranny. We wanted the right of self-representation. We wanted the right of being able to elect our leaders and have them speak for us. People gave their blood, their sweat, and their tears in order to expand the franchise and have the right to vote. We talk about all of that, but what it really boils down to for the students is how it's going to affect them. What are the issues at stake for them? Do they like the direction that the nation is going in, or do they want to change? And for different students, the reasons are different, but for all of them, what I hope is that over the course of our discussions, they can understand that it really begins at the ballot box. That's their single most effective way to voice their perspective and make their difference.
You know, I agree with you, but one of the things that I think students need to understand is, I remember talking to a student. I used to teach at City College here in Santa Barbara, and I was talking to this couple of girls about, you know, the whole issue of right to choose, and they said it's not an issue. There's always going to be a right to have an abortion. We're not concerned. We don't vote about that subject. And you know, if you think about it, it's probably true in California. It will never be an issue, but it may be true for 15 or 20 states where poor people aren't able to get an abortion. So there has to be in our thinking, if you're going to be socially, you know, responsible, to consider other people, and to consider people who don't have the resources to spend money to travel to another state. So I guess sometimes I agree that people tend to vote their own interests, but if you're going to be a member of a society, there should be some social awareness about how important it is to give everybody an opportunity to get the same benefits you do.
Well, and you also have to understand the lessons of history. You know, those who forget the mistakes of history are condemned to repeat them. And, you know, that is one of the biggest challenges, I think, with students is having a historical perspective.
So the young vote, the 18-25, people are predicting it's really going to be an important component in this election. Is that your view as well?
I think it'll be an important component. You know, you look at the difference between a presidential election and a midterm election, and the overall vote drops by about 16%, and the vote among young people drops by about 25%. And so, you know, anything that makes up some of that margin, young people have no idea of how much power they have as a group, as a cohort. If every young person voted, politicians would actually start paying attention to the issues of young people. They would start courting them as much as they court senior citizens who vote in huge numbers. And policies in this country would start changing. But it is kind of a chicken and egg. You know, politicians don't have to pay attention to young people because they don't vote. And a lot of young people don't vote because they don't see their issues being represented.
And today, there's so much focus on the presidential impact of what President Trump is doing, that, you know, we're looking at turning the Congress, but there are local races that are really important for a whole host of reasons. Are there any particular races in Ventura or Santa Barbara County that we should be particularly interested in?
Well, there's races all over the country. Maybe I'll start by just talking nationally. You know, they say it's going to be a wave election, but the interesting thing is for those on the Democratic side of the aisle, it kind of has to be a wave election just to bring things back to even. I don't think most people realize people pay attention to the presidency in the U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress, but I don't think most people realize that there's something called trifectas. In 26 states in this nation, Republicans have what's called a trifecta. They have the governorship and both houses of the legislature. Democrats have the same thing in only 8 states, 9 if you count New York, but there's some reasons to not count New York. But what that means is that unless that changes in this election and the next one, as we go into the rounds of redistricting, that means that one party has complete control, depending on whether their legislature draws the lines, in most states they do, they have complete control after redistricting to gerrymander, to draw district lines in ways that locks them into power for the next 10 years. So unless there is divided control in government, then the two parties aren't negotiating with each other to try to do what's in the best interest of constituents. They're more interested in preserving their political power. And so there's a lot at stake in races across the country at the local and state level, not just at congressional and U.S. Senate levels.
Now, you ran campaigns, and I don't know whether or not you used negative campaigning, but one of the issues, well, first of all, I have a two-part question. One is, does negative campaigning work? The second part of that is one of the things it does do is it turns a lot of people off. So we talk about, you know, voter interest, and I think that part of the reason people, particularly younger people, just don't want to be involved is because of the negative campaigning.
You know, sadly, negative campaigning does work, although it does turn off voters. It works, and it works especially well because we tend to have this disparity. Our system is so money-based that incumbents tend to be able to outraise challengers. The exception may be this year. There's a lot of contrary indications this year. There's a lot of challengers that are actually outraising incumbents. But as a general rule, incumbents are able to raise money in ways that challengers are not. And what that does is that as a candidate is trying to define themselves, if their opponent is able to spend money early and define them negatively, before they're able to define themselves positively, then the impression in voters sinks in at an early level. And especially when, you know, we have Citizens United and you have the ability of corporations and individuals to spend almost unlimited amounts of money in political campaigns, what that does is that makes campaigns often very lopsided.
It's amazing that if certain types of political donations are tax deductible now. I mean, that to me is just beyond the scope of any type of reason.
Yeah, we've gone way, way too far. We no longer have any meaningful campaign finance. In fact, we barely have any meaningful disclosure laws, letting sunshine be the great disinfectant on who's contributing to what kind of campaigns.
So explain this to me. How can Duncan Hunter, a congressman who's under indictment, be leading in the polls? There's other examples. You know, the quote unquote pimp in Nevada was on the ballot in Nevada, and he was on the ballot. I mean,
Duncan Hunter, he's in a very conservative area. He's running against an opponent who's both Palestinian and Mexican, and it's got kind of a funny name, and he's playing up that funny name, Omar Kampar Najjar. That race could go either way, but it is a very conservative district, and so the expectation is, despite being under indictment, that Duncan Hunter has a very good chance of winning. The pimp in Nevada actually recently died, so yeah. He's going to try to get elected while dead.
Right.
And then what will they'll actually post at the polling places that he's since deceased, and if he's able to get reelected in also a very conservative area, that's in Pahrump, Nevada, yeah. Nestled between Area 51, the Yucca Mountain National Lab, and the home of the closest legal brothel to Las Vegas.
So it's
And
so are you
in that area, if he gets reelected, then the Republican Party gets to pick his replacement.
implying that that area is not like Paris?
And that may be just slightly different than lovely Santa Barbara, California.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. AHA, helping teens achieve goals, surmount challenges, stop bullying, and communicate and listen effectively. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Tim Allison, professor of political science at CSUCI. And one of the things that we see today, parallel to the political campaign, is we see this whole Me Too movement, and it was sort of highlighted during the Kavanaugh debate. You would think now that women would be A, motivated to vote and motivated to make their voice heard. Is that going to be something that when the pollsters review this election, they're going to say women had a tremendous impact?
You know, I think it actually will be a year of the women. And it's not just the Me Too movement, but certainly the Me Too movement in the Kavanaugh hearings, but also parties' recruitment of candidates. This will be an election where I expect Democrats will do very well in this election. It'll be Donald Trump isn't on the ballot, but he's on the ballot, if you know what I mean. And I think that the Democrats have recruited a lot of candidates that represent a broad diversity, including gender diversity in this country. The last time we had a year of the woman in campaigning was coincidentally a year after the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings of 1991. In 1992, swept a lot of women into public office, and I think the same thing is going to happen this year.
And it's just kind of confounding that you see interviews in the various news media about women being asked how they support Trump, and their view is, in some cases, well, you know, sometimes good people do bad things, or you know, men act like boys sometimes, or the just excuses women give. And I'm a guy, and I don't think anyone should get a free pass. And it's just sometimes amazing to me. And I guess it's one of the problems of looking at any gender as a voting block. I guess everyone has different ideas, but it's just very surprising to me, particularly in the evangelistic group, where women continue to support Trump despite all of this misogyny.
Well, that's why I think that this will be somewhat of a wave election, is that those that are solidly on either camp, in terms of our tribalism, the 40% or so that will vote for their party's candidate, no matter what they do or how bad they are, because they feel the other party is worse. No matter what our person did, they're our person. But the elections aren't decided by those folks. The elections are decided by the individuals who voted for both Barack Obama and Donald Trump, the individuals who are the swing voters. And I think a lot of those swing voters don't like what they're seeing out of Washington, D.C. right now. They're actually, frankly, pretty disgusted by it. And those are the individuals who, if they do vote, will swing the election in a direction that sends a message to Donald Trump, frankly.
And this, you know, we talk about the Republican issues. There are some Democratic issues. I mean, whether it's the Bernie Sanders wing or the mid wing, if there still is a mid wing, where there's a sort of a revolution under the surface of what the Democratic Party stands for, if it stands for anything. So, you know, things aren't exactly perfect in the Democratic Party either.
Oh, Neil, it's a fascinating time to be a political scientist,
right?
Because I think that all of the institutions of democracy are under question, under review. There's a fight for the soul of both political parties, and this is a fun time. I'm never short of material to talk about in my classes. It's a wonderful thing.
Well, if you were at a meeting of activists in one of the Ventura, somebody's home in Ventura, and they were saying, "Do you think it's important to stand by your beliefs or to win?" How would you answer that question?
I think it's important to do both. I think it's important right at the very beginning stages to make sure we're recruiting candidates that we can be proud of, to recruit candidates that will reflect our values, because if we elect them, then they represent, our values. They represent us. They represent whatever political party you believe in. And if they're no longer representing those values, if they've fallen off the wagon, if they're going to be an embarrassment to the party, to the city, to the country, then they should no longer be an elected official, no matter what political party they belong to. And I think it's important to stand up for that. And if we lose that, we lose a part of our soul. If we're standing by somebody because they are part of our political party, as opposed to because we're proud that they represent us, then tribalism has run amok. And I'm afraid I'm seeing that much too often.
Well, what I find so interesting, there's a very, very close race going on in Arizona between a Republican and a Democrat, both women, to be senator. And Kirsten
Kirsten Sinema and Martha McSally, yeah.
right. And Kirsten Sinema is really running a good race. And she was in an interview a couple of days ago, and the interviewer said, "Are you proud to be a Democrat?" And whether she answered it this way because it was a good thing to do politically, because it's a red state, or whether she meant it, she said, "I'm not proud to be any party. I think there's problems with both parties. I'm just proud to be an Arizonian," or whatever the for a phrase to be, And I thought that was a really good answer. She was trying to detribalize the political party system and say, "Look, I want to do what's right. I don't want to just be identified." And what was so interesting is the headline was sort of a pejorative. She's rejecting the Democrats, which was so silly. First of all, she's trying to get elected in a red state, but second of all, she's actually giving it a good answer.
Yeah, it is pretty interesting. Those candidates running for public office, they never know how their remarks are going to be taken. And it's a difficult position to be in.
So the fake news stories that are around, I thought it was kind of stupid, like who reads fake news? And then I kind of realized I was too. I would go on Facebook and I'd read a factoid, and I would assume it was correct because I agreed with it. And now I'm very careful, or much more careful, in terms of looking at where it comes from. But it's very, it's human nature to want to, to verify your preconceived notions. And you can see how you could throw out a fact that's not a fact if it sort of agrees with your predetermined view of the world. So it's sort
Now,
of a very insidious.
the problem I don't think is just fake news. I mean, certainly there's a portion there. I think the problem is much more endemic than that. The problem is biased news. The problem is Facebook uses algorithms, and if you're getting your news off Facebook, most of my students actually get their news in some way, shape, or form off social media. They're getting it off Apple News. They're getting it on their phones. But if you're getting it from a social media site, it tends to be the news that you already, it reinforces your pre-existing beliefs. You're hearing news from your friends, and your friends all agree with you. And if they didn't agree with you, you probably unfriended them a while back. And so it tends to make us more solid in our opinions, and that isn't necessarily always a good thing.
Yeah, and the thing that I think we all have to realize is it's very easy to criticize somebody else for being gullible, but we're all gullible, and I think it requires some responsibility on our parts to sort of vet what we read and what we hear.
I want to take a moment and go back to the question that I didn't answer from you, which is about the races in Ventura County that are particularly interesting. And there's one that's just at the top of the list, and that's the congressional race, CD25. It's Katie Hill versus Steve Knight. Steve Knight's the incumbent Republican, and Katie Hill is a first-time candidate. I think she's about 31 years old, a very impressive story. She's outraising the incumbent, not just by a little bit. She's significantly outraising him. She's raised about $6 million to his, ballpark $2 million. For a challenger to outraise an incumbent, she is exciting the local population in ways that this area, in an area ranging from Simi Valley up to Palmdale and Lancaster, there hasn't been a Democratic candidate that's been able to put together this kind of a grassroots campaign in quite some time. They have on weekends, they have three shifts of volunteers going out, and the latest polls actually show her slightly ahead. So this is a race. Steve Knight is perfect for the district, as the district was maybe 10 years ago, which was a much more conservative, law enforcement friendly. He's a former police officer, and Katie Hill is young and articulate and represents a very different look. They couldn't be more different as candidates, and it's an exciting race to watch.
And it's another manifestation of how this local election for a local congressman, congresswoman is really a national referendum, because Katie Hill was here last week at a fundraiser, which was mobbed by people in Santa Barbara looking to give her money, because people realize it's not just about Ventura representation. It's about, flipping the House and changing the direction the government is going. And you're
Well,
listening.
it looks very strong for the Democrats to flip the House. I mean, they're 43 seats down right now, and in the midterm elections, the average is well, depending on what kind of numbers you use, the average is maybe 30 seats. So they've got a Democrats have to exceed the average, but when you have actually the average is maybe 12 to 20 seats. There's different ways to run the numbers, but when a president is actually below 50% in terms of their approval rating, then the average jumps up to 36 seat loss for the president's party. So the Democrats have to actually do a little bit better than that. They've got to get to 43, and the polls show right now, the election were held today, they'd be able to do that. Senate looks a little more challenging, but the House looks like it probably will flip from Republican to Democrat.
You're listening to AHA Presents About Education on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to AHA Presents About Education. I'm Neil Kreisel, and we're here today with Tim Allison, a professor of political science at CSUCI. And when you answer this question, be advised that I'm not young. What do you think of Joe Biden for 2020?
I think Joe Biden depends on whether Democrats decide that they truly want to win the race, because it goes against all of the local trends, the current trends of younger, more involved voters, of more progressive candidates, of candidates of color. It goes against all of those things. And the determination for electing Joe Biden is he's a nice guy. He's from a great state that we need to win, Pennsylvania, and he's the safe bet. And so, if Democrats decide among the plethora of candidates who will run, of the 2,000 candidates that will decide to put themselves forward as candidates for president, Joe Biden is a likable, safe bet who probably has the best chance of winning.
So let me give you three issues: Roe v. Wade, Medicaid, and Donald Trump. What do you think, whether it's for this election or in 2020, which of those three are going to be the most determinative as people going
Donald
into
Trump. It's all about Donald Trump. He's not on the ballot this year, but he might as well be. And in 2020, it's all about Donald Trump. And that's, in some ways, it's the danger for the Democratic Party, because they will be able to attract support that is a mile wide but only an inch deep. And if they can't tie Donald Trump to issues that matter to voters, then voters will continue to swing. This election, they'll swing away from Donald Trump, I think, this election in 2020, but they may just as well in 2024 swing back again. So, in order to get long-term support from voters, the Democratic Party is going to have to figure out a way to tie issues to Donald Trump. Just like right now in this election, 2018, Republican candidates are doing everything they can to localize elections, to make it not about Donald Trump, to make it about local issues. So both parties have their task ahead of them, but it's a pretty predictable playbook.
What's really astounding to me is how Donald Trump will say to the public that the Russian interference was done by Hillary Clinton. He just takes whatever issue that he's being attacked with and with no shame just turns it around to the other side.
Well, it must be pretty liberating to not be tied to facts.
Right. Well, Tim, thank you so much for being here, and thank you for all you do at CSUCI. They're very lucky to have you teaching political science in a period where political science is so important. You're listening to AHA Presents About Education. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.